We can discuss this more a bit later. All right. So basically, we studied quantum mechanics of spin 1/2 particle. And so the Hamiltonian of this quantum mechanics has been described in this way. W prime squared minus 1/2 h bar sigma 3 w. And so what we've been able to do, we've been able to solve this quantum mechanics, solve non-perturbatively. And so what we found the exact wave function of the ground state and conditions under which this ground state wave function exists. So what this means is that we found a ground state wave function. It was taking a form omega. It's a two component, either this or omega was equal to this, right? And so we've been able to solve this, solve non-perturbatively for any superpotential. W of phi. And so we observed that only one of these wave functions will correspond to a normalizable wave function depending on the properties of the superpotential. So that depends on phi. So phi is similar to the x coordinate in normal quantum mechanics. Okay, so let's see. So that's non-perturbatively. Now, we also discussed perturbatively the system. So by the way, this is a wave function which has a fermion number plus one, well, minus one to the f acted on this gives me minus one. So this is a fermionic state, and this is a bosonic state. And so then what we did, we studied this system perturbatively, and so we found that there is always a ground state. There is always a ground state at W prime of phi equal to zero. And whether the state is fermionic or bosonic depends on, if I am to solve this, so phi equals phi naught is a solution to this equation, right? So whether the state is bosonic or ground state bosonic or fermionic is determined by the second derivative of this wave function at the extremum of the superpotential. Sorry, second derivative of superpotential at the extremum. So if it is positive, right, so this is a number that we call lambda. So we showed that the ground state is fermionic. And likewise, when this number is negative, the ground state is bosonic. So what we did next, we actually looked at a particular example. And so the example that we discussed, started discussing was this model. So we have a superpotential phi to the fourth plus subleading corrections, plus subleading terms. So I'm assuming that in this model, our superpotential is a polynomial in phi. So we have lower order terms. So then we started drawing some plots, okay? So the zeros of the derivative of the superpotential will be 4 phi cubed plus equal to 0. So this is a cubic equation, right? And so generically we expect to have 3 roots. Okay, so let me start plotting the, so this is phi, this is a superpotential, and so at those points, those are the points at which the superpotential is extremum. Okay, so I call this 1, I call this 2, and I call this 3. And we can do perturbative analysis near each of these extrema. And so in this case, we have lambda positive, lambda negative, lambda positive. So this is a fermionic state. This is a bosonic ground state. And so here we have a fermionic ground state as well. So perturbative analysis led to the conclusion that there are 3 ground states. And so if we are to plot the potential energy, so this is 1, this is 2, and this is 3. So the potential energy is proportional to the derivative of the superpotential square. So what I need to do, I need to take a derivative of that and square what I get. And so it will take something like this. So there is clearly three minima. And so in each of the minima, for small fluctuations, the system behaves like a harmonic oscillator. So there will be a ground state. And whether the ground state with zero energy will be a bosonic or fermionic will depend on the sign of lambda, the sign of interaction with a magnetic term, which is the last term in the Hamiltonian. And so that was perturbative analysis. But the thing is that we know the solution, to the system non-perturbatively, okay? And so I guess I have to mention here that this omega, to remind you, that this wave function after normalization is e to the minus w. And I might be missing factors of h bar. Well, yes, it's this. And so the omega minus hat of phi is e to the plus w of h bar. And so in this particular model, we can see that the exact wave function, so there will be only one wave function. It's going to be this one, because w actually goes to plus infinity as phi goes to plus or minus infinity. So this will be normalizable. This is normalizable. Okay. And so what I can do is to actually plot what the exact wave function for the ground state in this system will look like, right? So again, there is 1, 2, and 3. Those are our 3 special points. So this is all phi. This was v of phi. This is phi, and this is just a component. I'm not going to put anything here because the wave function is 2 components. And we just look at the non-zero component of the wave function. And so the wave function, oh, maybe I can just put that we're looking at omega hat plus. So it's proportional to e to the minus w divided by h bar. And so whenever our superpotential has a minimum, our wave function actually has a peak. And likewise, here it's a maximum, so our wave function has a minimum, right? So the exact wave function will be something like this. Okay. So notice that the ground state wave function does not have any nodes, as we expect. Okay. So for the ground state, there shouldn't be any nodes. So it stays of the same sign. So here I choose it to be positive. And so it's minimized around 1 and 3. Okay, so this is exact wave function. Exact wave function. And I want to say that this is drastically different from the structure what we had before, right? Because in each of these vacuums here, we have a ground state wave function, and this ground state wave function was a Gaussian, right? So these are perturbative wave functions. They are localized in each of these minimum of the potential. And so here, what we see that our non-perturbative wave function actually explores the whole configuration space of the model, and it's being localized in a perturbative vacua 1 and 3. Okay. So this so clearly there so what we can do, we can ask ourselves, so what is going on? What actually happens as we go from perturbative perturbative analysis to non-perturbative? Well, perturbatively, once we construct Hilbert spaces, this Hilbert space never knows about this one and never knows about this one, right? So there is no way for any state here to know about to explore a larger configuration space. Because effectively, what perturbative theory is doing, they're just taking, we're pretty much making making a barrier to tunneling to another Hilbert space infinitely large, right? So we always, in doing perturbation theory, we're replacing the behavior of the potential here with a harmonic oscillator potential up to infinite values of field. So there will be, the tunneling is suppressed completely, while in true model, non-perturbatively, there can be tunneling, and so the wave function can explore different minima of the potential. I want to point out that, so psi 1 was a fermionic wave function, psi 2 was bosonic, and psi 3 is a fermionic as well. So what do we see here? We see here that once we allow tunneling is a non-perturbative effect, then there is a mixing. But if we ask ourselves, I thought about going more precise here, but then I figured that it will take too much time, and that will be one of the great papers to discuss for some of you guys as a reference. But I just give a qualitative picture of what is going on. So once we allow the tunneling, what will happen is that the wave function with the same fermion number, so you can think of this as a super selection sectors in the model, states which carry the same number can mix together. And so the picture that we have is that we started, so we started perturbatively. We started perturbatively with three states, psi 1, psi 2, and psi 3. Those were the ground states. And then once we turn on the tunneling, once we turn on the non-perturbative effect, we can form another basis in these ground states. And another basis is psi 1 psi plus psi 2, sort of a symmetric combination, psi 1 plus psi 3. And then we are left with another combination of ground states, which is psi 1 minus psi 3, and there is a psi 2. So this state is bosonic, this one is fermionic, and this one is fermionic. So the exact treatment tells us that this is a wave function corresponding to a true ground state, so the energy here equals to zero, and that's the only ground state. So that tells us that these two wave functions must correspond to eigenfunctions of the Hamiltonian with a non-zero energy. And so those two wave functions actually have the right multiplicity. In order to have a massive multiplet, we need one bosonic state and one fermionic state. So we have just the correct multiplicity. For the non-perturbative effect to lift those two states. for non-perturbative effect. In this case, it will be just tunneling to lift psi 2 and psi 1 minus psi 3 to a massive Susi multiplet. So let me draw you a picture. So exactly what is going on with the spectrum of the theory as we go from perturbative to non-perturbative. So we started perturbatively as having three Hilbert spaces, right? So we had three separate vacua, and we can build up excitations in each of them. So the first one was fermionic, right? Okay. So here I have E over h bar lambda 1, right? So this was our vacuum 1, okay? And the ground state was a fermionic state. Then the next vacuum was bosonic, right? So in this case, so what I'm plotting is E divided by h bar absolute value of lambda 2. So in the second vacuum, lambda 2 is negative. That's a bosonic state, bosonic ground state. So this was our vacuum 2. And now in the third vacuum, right? So the third vacuum, again, we had a ground state which was fermionic, right? So this is our third vacuum. And so here I have E over h bar lambda 3. Now, non-perturbatively, what will happen? There will be mixing between states in these different vacua, mixing due to tunneling. And so what we found that there is a truly non-perturbative effect. So, well, the ground state that will survive is a fermionic ground state. So this is a linear combination of psi 1 and psi 3. And then what we found is that those two states will have must be lifted. So in fact, in a very beautiful paper by Solomonson and Van Halten, I'll give a reference to this paper. So this computation, what you have to do, you have to compute a path integral in the instant on background and instant on pretty much, well, in a path integral formalism is an object that's responsible for tunneling between different vacua. So they did this computation and they showed that indeed those two ground states get lifted. And they get lifted, the energy here at which they are lifted is exponential minus C over H bar, where C is just some positive number. So this is, if you wish, this is psi 1 plus psi 3 you can think of. And this, what was psi 2. Okay? So besides those states, we also have these massive states in each of the vacua, but they are actually much, much further away in this scale. Yes? Oh, sorry, yes, thank you. This is the other linear combination. Yes. So what I want to point out is that semi-classically, in a limit as h bar, so when we do perturbation theory, remember that h bar entered in a, only up here, right? So it entered in the magnetic interaction. Without this magnetic interaction term, everything was everything was age bar independent, right? So that's the only place where age bar entered. And then what we did, we pretty much replaced omega double prime with a constant. And so that gave us a harmonic oscillator in a constant magnetic field. So we can actually keep further terms there. And then that will lead to a correction to a simple harmonic oscillator. So we will have higher order aharmonic terms in the oscillator. And so much like we can do in quantum mechanics we can take x squared oscillator and add x cubed term with a small coefficient. So that small coefficient will be, of course, you can show will be higher order in h bar. So whatever we will, whatever computation we will do, the corrections to the energy will be analytic in h bar. Okay. So that tells us that there is no way, this is something that I already mentioned, there is no way if you do a perturbative computation, you will ever see this effect. So any perturbative computations you will do will still guarantee you that there will be three ground states, because perturbative computations are analytic in H bar. And e to the minus 1 over h bar term is non-analytic, and the perturbation theory will never see. So any perturbative computation will not show non-analytic in h bar term. So this is very similar when you look at the quantum field theory. We say lambda phi to the fourth interactions, and you ask what are the corrections to some scattering amplitudes in this theory. What you will find out, that the corrections take an analytic form in the coupling. So in some sense, what you can think of is that this h bar plays the role of lambda in this lambda phi to the fourth field theory. And the only correction to the spectrum and whatever we will see will be corrections which are analytic in this H bar. And pretty much because of this, there will be no, you will never see this drastic effect as some of the ground states get lifted. So as I said, this is a computation which has been done in a Solomonson and von Holten paper. And for some weird reason, I have the paper in my office, but I don't have the reference to the paper here. But so Solomonson and von Holten. So those are the guys who pretty much computed this value C, showed that it's non-zero and that it's positive. Okay, so that's a very nice paper to get an introduction into instantons. But unfortunately, I thought that I will discuss this, but I'm afraid I would have to skip. Okay. All right, so another thing that that we studied is the Witten index, right? We discussed last time. So when we compute minus 1 to the f, the only trace of the operator minus 1 to the f. So the only states that contribute to this trace are the ground states. And so the trace in this vacuum, in the vacuum minus, in the vacuum 1, so we have a fermionic state, it contributes as minus 1. So the trace minus 1 to the f, minus 1 to the f, in the second Hilbert space will be plus 1, and in the third one is also going to be minus 1 because the ground state is fermionic. So trace perturbatively minus 1 to the f equals to minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 equals to minus 1, and that's exactly the same as the exact the trace non-perturbatively, so I would call it exact, minus 1 to the f, so it's equal to minus 1. So what we observe is that despite the fact that non-perturbative effects can make drastic changes to our theory, there are some properties of the theory that are invariant as we turn on non-perturbative effects in some sense. And so later today, I will give you a heuristic picture why we can think this is happening. So in other words, why what's known as a Witten index survives going to strong coupling. Okay. The reason why I need strong coupling, or in this case, non-perturbative effects, pretty much making h bar finite, is in this case, this exponential is not zero. It's a finite number. All right, guys, so any questions? No. Yes.
So I guess in the full field theory, can you have more than one ground state with like fermions and bosons? And not
true. Right, so in quantum field theory, if you get, and this is what we're going to discuss right now, is that if you compute a Witten index, and that Witten index will have to be zero. That Witten index will mean that, in principle, it can still be true that you have the same number of bosonic and fermionic ground states, and you don't know how many ground states you have. But what I will try to convince you now is that whenever the Witten index is zero, then you have to assume that there is no ground state. I mean, this is a very, very strong indication that there is no ground state. So so the only way you have a supersymmetric ground state when the Witten index is non-zero. I guess then your question is, if it is non-zero, can it be different from 1? Can it be minus 5 or can it be plus 5? Because if it is minus 5, strictly speaking, that simply tells you that you have 5 more fermionic ground states than bosonic, but in reality, that really means that you have just 5 fermionic ground states. So you cannot sort of have a fermionic and bosonic ground states. See, because fermions and bosons, they like to pair once you turn on interactions, right? What happened here, we have a bosonic ground state, and it wanted to pair with a fermionic ground state due to interactions and get a mass. Okay? So that's why what we'll always have,
we cannot lift this one, right, if you think, because in order for this to get mass, the theory is still supersymmetric, so it must pair with some other state. But it must pair only with the state that has at least semi-classical with the same energy. And there is simply no state for that to happen. I will make these arguments much more precise in the example. But coming back to your question, if we take a pure Young-Mills theory, SUN, we will make that theory supersymmetric, something that we will hopefully get in this course, then we can compute a Witten index. It turns out for the supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, SUN, the Witten index equals 2n. That tells you that you have n ground states. Now, whether those ground states are fermionic or bosonic, it's to a large extent depends on the convention, you know, because how you define the fermion number, right? So strictly speaking, in all this discussion, nothing would have changed if I call whatever I call fermionic bosonic ground states. Yes, please.
So in that formula,
yeah.
Yes, yeah. What are you actually tracing over there?
So the trade, okay, so it's a good question. So, I'm going to do it here. So if I have an operator, a trace of operator in some Hilbert space, right, and you write down this curly H. So what do I mean by that? I mean by that sum n equals 0 to infinity, m operator on n. So that's the exact statement. Except that sometimes you have to worry that these expectation values are well defined. And so usually what people do is introduce a suppressing exponential factors. So the precise definition of the Witten index is trace minus 1
to the f. E to the minus beta h, so this is a Hamiltonian, and you take a limit as beta goes to plus infinity.
Well, see, this guy, well, without this, at each massive level, you have the same number of Bosonic and fermionic states, right? So minus 1 to the F on a massive level is always 0. So this simply makes the sum well-defined, because you know there is a statement that if you have an infinite sum with which is not sign definite, then you have to be careful how you take the sum, right? Yes,
please.
Yes. Well, as long as you make it convergent, yes. So I can have beta being non-zero. Any non-zero number, because the spectrum is unbounded from a ball. Absolutely correct. So, but this sort of emphasizes the fact that I can just look at the ground state.
I mean, this kind of really is the question, but does it have anything to do with temperature? And
it can be interpreted as temperature. Yeah, so that will be, well, for example, without minus 1 to the F,
right?
This would be just a Cartesian function, yeah, with quantum mechanics, right? At temperature beta,
yeah.
Okay. And this one is a Clinton index. Okay. Very good. So let's see. So we did one example. So there are two more examples that I want to discuss, but I will go much faster because the procedure is really really similar. And so let's look, so that you won't get lost into the details. What the purpose of this discussion is to give you an idea about whether or not what non-perturbative fractions can do. So some the question that asked just before, how do we know how many ground states we have, and if we get, for example, the Witten index being equal to 0, does it really mean that there is no supersymmetric ground state? So I will try to convince you that it does really mean that there is no supersymmetric ground state in most cases. Yes.
Sorry, can I pick once more on the temperature?
Sure.
It doesn't mean that at zero temperature, the Witten index might not be well defined. And I mean,
well,
if you interpret beta as a temperature.
But actually, if you think of this, right, it was you who said this, that I didn't need to take beta, right? I will get the same answer whatever beta is, right?
Yeah, but unless it's zero.
Unless it's zero. So that makes Witten index being a topological quantity. It's it's unchanged against continuous deformation of the parameter,
yeah.
Except that there is a subtlety about setting beta equal to zero, and that's precisely because of that subtlety that we need to regulate the Witten index. We either have to regulate it, and that's the way to regulate it, or we need to make a prescription. How do we compute the sum of a series in which a different term in a sequence can change sign?
Right.
And there is, in a calculus, there is this theorem, right? So if I have A to the M, and it's a sign-changing sequence, then I can get, by reshuffling terms, I can get whatever number I want as a limit.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking about this physically and its significance.
I would say that this is a... So that's precisely, if you wish, precisely, if I do it, not this, then a person who would like to take mathematics very seriously would say, oh, this is not well defined. I can get any number I want, and the answer is correct. But there is a right number, and all the other ones are incorrect. So the right number is obtained by putting the suppression pattern. Or, in other words, a prescription that we go from lower states and we go up and up. See, again, we want to introduce objects in our models that will be useful, right? And so, the usefulness of this object that whenever, first of all, it's a topological quantity, as you were explaining. And because it's a topological quantity, if there is a way we can compute it, then it better be the same. Well, it doesn't change against continuous variation. In fact, it is precisely this argument that I will use to show that, in some sense, if you think, okay, you are a little bit driving ahead, that how can we justify that the rhythm index doesn't change as they go from non-perturbative to perturbative? I can think about quantum corrections as I have a coupling, and I make that coupling change from zero to plus infinity, right? Or making it very large. So since the Witten index is a topological number, it must not change under the smooth variations. That's why if you compute a Witten index perturbatively for some finite small values of coupling, you are guaranteed to get exactly the same number for the Witten index if you were to compute it at large coupling. Okay. But it is this intuition that I want to make more precise with a couple more examples. Right. So there is real usefulness, and you try to remove that usefulness by, removing e to the minus beta h.
No, I'm not trying.
No. It's all very great question. Look, I would have forgotten, about the topological property. I wouldn't mention it. So you should interrupt me as much as you can, and there is a possibility that we can get a better picture of what's going on.
Could you explain more about the continuous deformation?
Yes. So I'm going to do it right now.
Okay, so if lambda is equal to zero, from zero to non-zero, is that a continuous or continuous?
We'll talk about this. Okay. Let's ask exactly this same question in 15 minutes, if I didn't answer. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to look at two other models. And the models that I want to look at are the ones that are just characterized by a different superpotential. So this is our example two. So in this second example, I'm going to look at the superpotential which is cubic, cubic plus, again, it's a polynomial plus some leading. Plus some leading terms. So if I have a cubic function, right? So generically there will be it will be like this, and so there will be generically two extrema. So in this case lambda is negative. In this case lambda is positive. So this is a fermionic ground state. This is a bosonic ground state. So with an index in this model equal to minus 1 plus 1 equal to 0. So this is perturbative value. But we know, so the perturbation theory will tell us that there are two ground states, and we can repeat the same analysis as we did here, and what we will find out is that those two ground states will start interacting with each other, and due to the interactions, they will form a massive multiplet and will be lifted. They will get a finite energy, and that finite energy will be non-perturbative in H bar, much like it happened here. And so the reason why we know that, because we know that non-perturbatively, neither of the wave functions will be normalizable, right? So there are only two possible wave functions. One is this, which is e to the minus w, and the other one is this, e to the plus w. And neither of them is normalizable, right? Because omega with size will go from minus infinity to plus infinity. So there is no ground state, no ground exact statement, no ground state. And the Witten index exact equals to zero. Again, I'm emphasizing the fact that the Witten index did not change whether we computed it perturbatively or non-perturbatively. However, there is a drastic change in the spectrum. We know that there is no ground state. All right. Thank you. pretty good. So I suppose that this happens generically, right? That's if you give me a cubic function, a cubic polynomial, it's very likely to be this. However, you might tune coefficients of that cubic polynomial in a special way. And so the special way how you can tune it, you can tune it like this, example 3. And it's important this transition from example 2 to example 3 that we will be discussing. Example 3, so you can tune those subleading terms in a special manner. So tune
subleading terms terms in example 2 in a special manner. So in such a way that our superpotential will take this form. Okay? So it depends on a bunch of subleading coefficients, and I just choose them, tune them, did a fine tuning and got this. So, but now, if I have, so the property that the superpotential that we are dealing with have the same leading term. The dominant contribution is the same. However, perturbatively here, perturbatively, W prime equals 3 phi squared plus 1, and it doesn't have extremum. It doesn't have any zero. So in this model, what we see that if we tune the subleading coefficients to a special value, there is no ground state perturbatively, even sort of classically. By perturbatively, I will use interchangeably classically. And the reason is because our function is something like that. Okay, so there is no extremum. So this is never equal to zero. So there is never a solution. So in this case, SUSY is broken classically. So it turns out that if you think more about this transition from example 2 to example 1, then you can understand the whole issue of that underlines a lot of supersymmetry, which is analytical properties of various quantities. So let's just discuss this. So I'm going to keep those two blackboards there, and we'll come back to it. So in particular, so what happens if we look at the generic cubic polynomial there and the polynomial here is that phi squared disappears, right? So what we can do, we can suppose that we have a polynomial of this type, and I'm sorry that I'm using lambda before lambda was a curvature at the extremum of the superpotential. But now I am using it as just a coefficient here, plus ta ta ta. So lambda is a parameter as we vary, right? So we change the value of lambda, and we ask the question: suppose we do that, right? So notice that our potential for large values of phi does not change, right? So we are changing a potential at the subdominant level. So it's 3 phi squared plus 2 lambda phi plus ta 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 squared, right? So the leading behavior of the potential stays the same. And we ask the question, how does my spectrum change as I do this deformation of the superpotential? Well, what we expect that the energy levels are functions of lambda, okay? And if we think that lambda is a small parameter, what we can try to do is we can try to do a perturbative expansion perturbative expansion of this E sub I of lambda. So it will have some infinite sum, lambda to the n. And of course, we have to worry what is the radius of convergence, what is the radius of convergence of this series. Of convergence. So in particular, in quantum field theories, very often the radius of convergence of perturbative theory is zero. So the perturbative series are always asymptotic series, and so usually in quantum field theory, perturbative expansions are asymptotic, which simply means that that series has a zero radius of convergence. And the reason why that is the case is because, so this is so, because usually there are terms which are non-analytic in lambda, because there are corrections, non-analytic analytic in lambda. So those are corrections that, for example, suppose that lambda is a coupling, right? So let's think about lambda phi to the fourth theory. Lambda is positive, right? When we do our perturbation series, there will be a series expansion in lambda. But I will claim in a second, and I will give you an answer to that in a sec. I will give you an argument for that in a minute. But what type of non-analytic corrections there can be? For example, if there are terms of order 1 over lambda, for example, e to the minus 1 over lambda. So those are the terms that actually behave in a highly non-analytic way as we change the sign of lambda, right? So when we talk about convergence of a given series, the series must converge for positive and negative values of lambda. However, if you have a non-analytic terms of this type, it really matters whether lambda is positive or negative. For example, if we look at the Taylor series, so this equality sign means Taylor expansion. Taylor expansion for lambda plus, lambda is approach zero plus, a positive, small positive number. As you know, a Taylor series expansion of this function is zero plus zero times lambda, plus zero times lambda squared, plus zero times lambda cubed, and so on. Any coefficient of the Taylor series expansion will be zero. And actually, that is the reason that corrections of this type will never contribute, will never contribute to analytic expansions of the energy level. On the other hand, all I have to do is to take exactly the same correction and change the sign. So now lambda approach to zero from minus one, and now you immediately see that this correction blows up. Okay? So the property of the non-analytic correction, and in particular these terms that give rise to a zero radius of convergence of the perturbation theory, is that they change widely depending whether lambda is plus or minus, right? So coming back to our quantum field theory example, how do I know that such things exist in lambda phi to the fourth theory? The reason why I do know about that is because if I look, I'm talking about lambda phi to the fourth theory, so my potential energy, say, I might have a mass, right? And then I have a coupling, phi to the fourth. And so if I put lambda equal to zero, then I just have a free field phi, right? And then I have a self-interacting field. So there is, I can think about developing Taylor series expansion, writing down my Feynman diagrams, and doing the computation. This is what you guys have learned in a quantum field theory class. And in doing so, whatever you will compute will have a nice expansion in terms of lambda. Now, I claim that in this model, there are corrections of this type. So how do I know? If I look at a functional integral with this potential, and I substitute lambda goes to minus lambda, I just flip a sign, then I know that my functional integral will diverge. The reason why it will diverge, because this term will always be larger than pi squared. And when I compute a functional integral, I have to evaluate it over the whole space of the fields. So in other words, think of it as if you have a Gaussian integral. So if you feel more comfortable, you can think of this, that you have an integral from minus infinity to plus infinity dx, e to the minus x squared plus lambda x to the fourth. Right? Minus lambda x to the fourth. So what I can do, I can expand for small values of lambda, right? And so I can do a Taylor series expansion, n equals 0 to infinity, I will have whatever, minus x to the fourth to the nth power e to the minus x squared over n factorial, and evaluate this integral, right? Evaluate this integral, and I will get times lambda to the n, right? And I will get something like, you know, an analytic expansion. But I also know that this expansion has a zero radius of convergence, because once I change the sign of lambda, once lambda becomes becomes negative, then lambda phi to the lambda x to the fourth will cause the integral to diverge. It's exactly the same reason. It's exactly the same reason that in phi to the fourth quantum field theory, wherever the perturbative expansion you will do is asymptotic expansion, it has zero radius of convergence, precisely because functional integral will not be convergent. Actually, the same is true, and this is a very famous argument by Dyson in electrodynamics. So the quantum electrodynamics, the theory is that we use at least perturbatively to test our quantum field theories to doing the best computations. You know, if you compute the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron, that's, you ask somebody, is that the most impressive agreement between theory and experiment in the context of quantum field theory? Quantum electrodynamics actually suffers exactly the same problem. And it has been pointed out by Dyson. And what happens in QED, what happens in quantum electrodynamics is that you can show that the path integral will diverge. So the only thing that enters in a QED is not the electron charge. If you look, it enters as a fine structure constant. So it enters only as a square of the electron charge. So if you make this change, E squared goes to minus E squared, then you can show that, well, perturbatively, what will happen is that the QED vacuum becomes unstable. You will start producing electron and positron pairs, and you just destabilize the theory. On a more formal level, you can show that the path integral will diverge. So all these examples are a sort of justification of the statement that I made, that usually these series expansions in normal quantum field theories is asymptotic, has zero radius of convergence. And that's where supersymmetry is excellent, because in a supersymmetric field series, such series expansion have a finite radius of convergence. In particular series in which, going back to our example, so in the example when we modify the subleading behavior of the potential, the deformation of the energy spectrum with respect to those parameters, we expect to be analytic and nice, because we do not change the sort of the stability properties, if you wish, of the theory. So in theories, so if the deformation is subleading, We expect the perturbative expansion in that parameter to converge. Okay, so have a finite radius of convergence. So what this tells us, yes.
She just said from the theories in general.
Right, but if you ask the reason what is happening is that in this model, lambda 5 to the 4, that's the easiest thing for me to explain, right? So we looked at two models, right? In quantum field theory, we looked at this potential, which is m squared phi squared, right, plus lambda 5 to the 4. And then we looked at the Gaussian integral, right? So in Gaussian integral, f of x was x squared plus lambda x to the 4th, right? So notice that what we are doing in order to make this drastic convergence property, right, we are changing the sign of the leading exponential. And so my point was that if you do that, then you should not expect to have a well-defined convergent perturbative series. On the other hand, if what you are doing, you are changing the coefficient of the sub-leading terms while keeping the asymptotics unchanged, then you should not expect any drastic changes in your theory. Okay, and that's where this statement comes from.
So,
yeah.
Why is it bad to have the black spilling and keep that deep in?
I didn't say that it's bad. I just said that the argument that I want to make is to make a clear distinction. When do we, if we do a perturbative analysis in quantum field theory or in this quantum mechanical model, when do we expect a perturbation theory to converge? And so the statement extends to the question. It's clarified right now. I think it allowed me to state more precisely that as long as we change, as long as we keep asymptotics unchanged, so we expect the perturbation theory to be well behaved. So the easiest way is we can do this, right? So we can study analytic properties of this integral. So x to the fourth lambda x squared, right? So we can do Taylor series expansion in lambda, and you can actually prove probably this order of works that it's converging. All right. So
very good. So what this tells us, what lesson can we make? I'm gonna go my examples. We'll go up there, and this one also go up there. I'm trying to figure out the blackboard with the least thing written on it. Right. Right. So what this tells us is that if we vary a subleading parameter, and the statement is that if we expect, in other words, we expect that if we vary a subleading parameter, subleading parameter in a model. So the spectrum is analytic under such variations. So what this implies. This implies that if For example, we look at the energy of the lowest state in the spectrum. I call this state vacuum. If the energy of the vacuum as a function of lambda, it must be an analytic function, right? And if it is non-zero generically, then we would say that it's very likely that supersymmetry is broken. Okay, so there could be a special values of this parameter lambda in which the vacuum energy is zero, but because we expect it to be an analytic function, so if it is generically non-zero, then well, it's generically non-zero, and so we have SUSY being broken. On the other hand, so this is more precise statement. So if the energy of the vacuum as a function of lambda is equal to zero generically, okay, then we expect that the supersymmetry is not broken. Because what we have a function which is zero, and this function is an analytic function, and it stays being zero as we change lambda. That's what the word generically means. And so in this model, we expect SUSY to be unbroken. So so how can you think of this? Well, suppose let's look back at our model, right? So if we can ask what will happen with the ground state perturbatively as we vary the parameters of the superpotential while keeping the asymptotics fixed. So I fix my asymptotics of the potential, and I do the deformation. So it's clear that no matter what I will do, there will be at least one extremum, right? Because what happens here is that it grows up here and it grows up here, right, as we go in the field space to minus infinity or to plus infinity. So as long as I keep the asymptotics unchanged, that tells me that there must exist at least one extremum, right? There must be at least one minimum, because we have a nice smooth function that grows to infinity at both sides. So which means that somewhere inside it must attain a minimum value. At least one extremum. And now I know that that extremum will have zero energy, and I also know that since the variation I am doing, I am keeping asymptotic fixed, I know that the energy will be generically zero. That's why, just by looking at asymptotics, I would say that SUSY must be preserved. Okay. So is the argument clear? Notice that as I do this deformation, I might change the number of perturbative vacuum, because as long as I keep this asymptotics fixed, I can deform it in this way that I put this bump down here, and so I just have one vacuum. Okay. So the number of vacuum can change, but this guarantees that there will always be at least one such vacuum. And the vacuum that I will be tracing is this one, okay? So this is the one that will have generically zero energy, and because it must be an analytic function, it will be zero always, okay? So now this vacuum, so you can see, you can actually show that under smooth variation, the Witten index is unchanged. Well, you just have to think, so what will happen with the function if I keep the asymptotics of the function fixed? What could happen with the extrema of this function? And you will convince yourself that whenever you do this deformation, then the extrema can disappear, but Andre Appiah as you do the deformation. But whatever Appiah or this Appiah will actually will actually come with a different curvature, so with different values of what we call lambda plus and minus. So they will always appear or disappear as bosonic plus fermionic states, and that would guarantee that the Witten index is unchanged. So because of these arguments here, it's clear why there is no why we should expect that supersymmetry is broken as we go from example 2 to example 3. Because what we did there, I emphasize that we kept there, we kept the leading asymptote, the leading behavior of the superpotential unchanged. And we were changing the subleading terms. And so we changed the subleading terms and we showed that the supersymmetry is classically broken. So there is no supersymmetric vacuum at all. And so as we make small variations staying in that regime, that guarantees us that the vacuum energy is never zero. And so according to this statement, we expect that the supersymmetry is broken generically. Yes?
There is actually a zero energy correction.
Well, so the model that we are doing, remember we studied quantum mechanics, right? So our quantum mechanics is characterized by a single function. That single function is Doppler. We showed that in that quantum mechanics is supersymmetric. And we know that the ground state in the supersymmetric quantum mechanics has a zero energy if supersymmetry is unbroken. And we showed that perturbatively the ground state is the one in which the superpotential has an extremum.
Yeah, but in the case of there, it also perturbatively have a ground state. So,
but see, I look at that ground state, and I ask for that. Okay. It's not a precise statement what I'm saying. So I'm giving, this is what we discussed a little bit before. So if you get the Witten index being zero, it does not imply that you don't have ground state. It implies that it's highly likely that there is no ground state. And the argument is the following. So suppose in this model, right? In this model, there is no. In example 3, you agree that there is no ground state. But I can do small fluctuations. I can, for example, turn on lambda. And if I add to that term plus lambda pi squared, then there will be an extremum. And if there will be an extremum, or at least I can tune coefficients in such a way that there will be no extremum at lambda equals 0. But whenever lambda is not equal to 0, I will have an extremum. Right? So that would mean that there is a small subdominant correction, and this subdominant correction is responsible whether or not I have a vacuum. Now you can think about quantum corrections as being subdominant corrections to your classical analysis, and so you would expect that in a model in which it is as you change some parameter. And you classically don't find that there is no ground state. You expect that quantum corrections can generate such corrections, and so there will be no vacuum.
For the last step, I could follow. So the quantum corrections can, if you don't start out by the ground state, your quantum corrections can create one.
No, so the argument is the following. Suppose you what I'm saying is that the existence of the ground state is a pretty subtle statement. Okay, if the existence of the ground state relies on whether or not the ground state exists depends on a tuning of subdominant corrections, then my point is that you cannot trust that ground state. Suppose you did your semi-classical analysis and you found the ground state. And you found then that whether or not that ground state exists will depend if you classically deform a potential. Okay, so you deform classically a potential, deforming subdominant terms in that, and you found that that vacuum disappears. Something like going from there to here. Then my point is that you should not trust the vacuum that you found semi-classically there to be stable against quantum corrections. Because quantum corrections, you would expect that generate some corrections to your classical potential, and so the corrections that could be generated will be generated in such a way that they will live. And so this is just words, but it's actually words as far as quantum field theory is concerned. In the context of quantum mechanics, what we discuss, we actually have a rigorous analysis because we can solve this model exactly, and that's why it's such a beautiful quantum model. Because we can come up with this intuitive picture what will happen with our model as we vary, as we ask what happens with quantum corrections, and then we know the exact answer, whether or not our intuition is correct. Okay. So any questions? No? All right, and I already mentioned this, so I'll just say one more time. So it's a subtle, it's much more subtle thing, and a good reference is a written paper. But so let me give you the reference to the Witten index paper. Of course, in the paper that Ed wrote, that index was not called Witten index. Later, once people realize how useful it is. So this is nuclear physics B 202 1982 to 53. And so in a nutshell, the argument is really that we think about something that we just discussed right now. We think about quantum correction as a deformation of a classical potential. And moreover, we think about quantum corrections as modification of the subleading terms in the classical potential. And in those cases, we expect the generality will hold. So if the supersymmetry is generically unbroken, then it is unbroken by quantum corrections. And if it's generically broken, then it will be broken by quantum corrections. Right, so that completes the discussion of supersymmetric quantum mechanics, almost, because some of you kept asking about why is there quantum field theory? And so that's exactly what we're going to do. Now we're going to write down a Lagrangian for our quantum mechanics, so we'll probably spend one or two more lectures where we rephrase everything that we did in a language of action, Lagrangians, and the reason we're going to do that because we're going to introduce the notion of superfield and superspace and learn how we can very easily write down supersymmetric actions. So for example, if you know, in other words, we want to answer the following question. So that you have a bigger picture. So somebody gives you a Hamiltonian, 1/2 pi squared, where pi is a conjugate momentum to phi, plus an arbitrary potential. Okay? And we know it's a supersymmetric, right? So it's a supersymmetric quantum mechanics. But it took us a lot of work to show that it's supersymmetric. We have to find out what are the supercharges, and we have to show that the supercharges satisfy the supersymmetry algebra. But we can ask, what if there is a third derivative here? Or what if there are some other corrections? What if this vector is not 1/3, but 1/2, but 3? Will it be supersymmetric or not? So in fact, these questions are very difficult to answer. If we think in terms of just say, Hamiltonian in terms of the component piece. So what we want something much more robust, something that a framework that allows us automatically to say that the model is supersymmetric or not. And such a framework exists, and this framework is known as superspace, superspace plus superfield. And in order to develop this formalism, what we will need to do, we need to recast supersymmetric quantum mechanics that we discussed right now, really has 0 plus 1 dimensional quantum field theory. Okay. So in other words, we want to rewrite the model in this way. So it's an integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, dt of some Lagrangian that's of some field. And we want to do it in such a way, so if we have the action and we have a Lagrangian, that if we compute the Hamiltonian, right, from this action, we will get back our supersymmetric quantum mechanics Hamiltonian. Okay. It turns out that the model that we discussed here will be the simplest one in which we can do the superspace and superfield realization, and it will allow us to understand much easier the representation of the supersymmetry algebra. Okay? So that's the logic what we want to do. Okay? Because now, once we move to 4 dimensions, then we will always be living in this superspace. Okay? So we will never write down, well, I'm lying, we will do a little bit in components, but most of the analysis, and if you read papers, so people never talk about components. People never in this language. They are not even in this language. They are never in this language easier. Because that language is also not useful. You give me a Lagrangian, how do I know that it's supersymmetric or not? They are in the language that we will discuss. Okay? So let's start. So let's introduce some definition. Okay, so I'm going to introduce a classical Grassmann means. So Grassmann means anti-commuting. So I'm introducing psi equals to root h sigma minus and the conjugate field psi r root h sigma plus. So we still have our quantum mechanics, right? So let me remind you the quantum mechanics that we have. So we have the supercharges of this type plus phi pi. And then we have Q delta equals sigma plus prime of phi minus I phi. And then we have the supersymmetry algebra Q delta was equal to 2H, where H is a Hamiltonian there. And then in addition, QQ equals to Q delta, and the commutator was vanishing. So I have an explicit realization of my Grassmann parameters, psi and psi bar, as 2x2 matrices. And so you can verify that they satisfy this algebra. This is H. Okay? And then we have psi bar equal to 0, and then psi equal to 0. So I would think about psi and psi bar as operators in Schrodinger picture. I will think about these as operators in Schrodinger picture. So what we would like to do, once we go from a Schrödinger picture to a Heisenberg picture, so our Schrödinger operators will become time dependent. Okay. So if you look at the Hamiltonian here, okay, so this sigma three, is actually a commutator of sigma plus and sigma minus, and so the beauty of introducing this psi and psi lambda is that I can write down, remember that when we deal with quantum field series, there is no H bar. And so you can think that what I am doing with my quantum mechanics as a set of quantum field series, I want to do a field redefinition in such a way that I will get rid of the H bar dependence. And so that rescaling that I introduced along with introduction of two additional fields, two additional Heisenberg operators, actually removes H by the Hamiltonian, and so our supersymmetric quantum mechanics phase is more. And can I please change back to F being my potential? So the I don't know why I was switching back and forth to the norm. This our supersymmetric quantum mechanics. We know that it's supersymmetric and we would like to discuss it. So I'm going to make a statement and let's see. And in the remaining 5 minutes, we'll do what we can. So the claim is, I said that we will be looking for the action that gives rise to this Hamiltonian, and such an action exists. So it will be an action which will depend on three fields, phi, psi, and psi bar. And this action, so I have to think of this as fields in the Heisenberg representation, right? So they were operators in my quantum mechanics. Now, I started thinking about them as operators in the Heisenberg picture. And now if I want to formulate my quantum mechanics as zero plus one dimensional quantum field theory, those Heisenberg operators become fields. So at this level, this is just a classical action. We will quantize it. And so the claim is, and we will prove this. So the action takes the following form. It's an integral over dt, 1 half phi dot squared. Then I have, we call it not data because we are doing classical classical discussion for now. So this is psi bar, the conjugate psi, plus pi psi dot. Dot means a derivative with respect to time, minus 1 half f prime squared plus 1 half f double prime psi commutator. So the claim is that if we take our open one double matrix volume 1 and look at classical mechanics, the claim is that if we start with this action and we ask what is the Hamiltonian corresponding to this action, we will get this Hamiltonian. Okay? We will derive this in a second and we will quantize this action later. So the only thing is that the unusual part, what Landauer Lipschitz will not tell you in volume 1, is that those fields psi and psi star, they're actually resonant variables. So what we need to do before we can discuss this, we need an intro to Grassmann algorithm. So this is what we will do next time. Yep.
Are you commutator?
No, it's correct. It's a, what we have here is a commutator. The reason is that eventually we want to get something like that, and it is a commutator here. And
And the reason why that was accommodated here, because we wanted to get rid of this H bar, and the way we get rid of this H bar by rewriting sigma 3 as a commutator of sigma plus and sigma minus, which are hourly scale Fermionian variables. The interest of Grassmann calculus takes about 10 to 15 minutes, but we don't have it. So we're going to do it next time.